Parshas Vayera deals with the first several Makos, and in particular, we're going to discuss the attempts of Paro's Chartumim, his sorcerer, difficult word to translate, to copy Moshe and Aaron to perform the same Makos. The first thing that happens is that Moshe, Aaron, throws the staff down, it turns into a snake, and then they do the same thing. The Chartumim, they throw their staves down, and they turn into snakes, and then Vayivla, Mate, Aaron, as Matosam, Aaron's staff swallows their staves, and Aaron wins. Then they go on, the Makas Dam, Aaron turns the water of Mitzrayim into blood, Paro's Chartumim do the same thing. Paro says, okay, we can do this too, we're not so impressed yet. Paro said, not impressed. The same thing happens with Makas Tzvardea. Aaron makes Tzvardim, Paro's Chartumim makes Tzvardim, and then again, Paro's not impressed. Bayar Paro, Paro's okay. Finally, when it comes to Kinim, the Chartumim, for some reason, have trouble. They can't duplicate this, and they say, Etzba Elokimhi. But anyway, Paro doesn't give it anyway, but at least here the Chartumim somehow concede that they can't do what Moshe and Aaron did. Now, in Tanakh, there are numerous exhortations against Kishuf and all of Kishuf, divination, and all its various family of things, astrology, Losa Onenu, Losa Nachashu, Kashefa Losa Chaya, Kalov Yedoni Mos Yumas. There are numerous psukim banning all kinds of sorcery, necromancy, witchcraft, astrology, the whole passel of related occult practices. What's unique about this parasha is that this is one of the very few, perhaps only two accounts in the Torah of actual witchcraft being practiced. The Torah's prohibitions are normative, they're imperatives, don't do this usually. But here, this is an actual account, what seems to be an account of actual sorcery being practiced. The other account, as we discussed earlier, is the story in Sefer Shmuel, where Shaul is desperate, God will not communicate with him, no nevuah, no urim v'tumim. So out of desperation, Shaul decides on the eve of a critical battle, which indeed he dies in that battle, Shaul wants to consult, wants to find out, get some glimmering of what's in store for him, what his fate is going to be. So Shaul says, it says, Lo ano Hashem, Hashem would not answer him, gam b'chalomos, neither through dreams, gam b'urim, neither through urim v'tumim, gam b'nevim, neither through prophecy. Finally, Shaul says, okay, we're desperate, we have no choice, we'll go find a balas ov, we'll go find a woman who can communicate with the dead. What balas ov is exactly is not clear. Chazal give different ov and yidoni. It has to do with some kind of necromantic practice, bones under armpits, or other types of occult ideas. Basically, we're not going to get into exactly how it's done, but some way of communicating with the dead. In this case, the woman asks Shaul. First, she's scared. She knows that Shaul has exterminated all the practitioners of ov. She says, Shaul says, don't worry. Shaul was dressed as a commoner. He says, don't worry, I'll keep you a secret. You can trust me. And she said, who do you want me to raise? I want you to raise Shmuel, Shaul's former mentor who had been dead. So indeed, she raises Shmuel. The story goes, Mi alela, who shall I raise for you? She said, Shmuel. Then when the woman saw Shmuel, Vatizak b'kol gadol, she cried out in a great voice. She said, somehow she realized it was Shaul. Lamari misani, vato Shaul. Shmuel is not happy. Shaul asked her, what does he look like? Ish zakein olev hu otem il, an old man wearing a cloak, a garment of some sort. Shaul realized it was Shmuel. He recognized the dress, apparently. Shmuel was upset. Lomar her gastani, why have you disturbed me to raise me? Shaul said, I'm worried about the plishtim. And Shmuel said, you're in trouble. Hashem sar me'alecha, you'll be with me tomorrow in heaven. God is angry at you, etc. And that's basically the story, and indeed, that's what happened. The next day, Shaul and his three sons died. The Jews lost a catastrophic battle against the Plishtim. Shaul and his three sons were killed. Yonah's son, other sons were killed. And that's how the first half of Shmuel Aleph ends. So the question I want to discuss today is, does our tradition believe that these stories ought to be interpreted literally? Do sorcerers and practitioners of the occult really have the power to perform magic, sorcery? Or is there something else going on in these stories? Now, I always point out to people, that my kind of pet thing is that whenever somebody says Judaism believes X, it's almost always an oversimplification. There is very, very little. Rabbi Zakim is speaking about the 13 principles of faith, and even those have been much debated about whether those were universally accepted or not, but very, very little that you can say definitively Judaism believes X, and it's certainly the question of the existence of sorcery. There are obviously certain things that we do. We believe in God, we believe in the Torah, we believe in Hashgacha Pratis, but beyond the very, very core basics, almost nothing can be said to be universally agreed to be true. And the question of how to interpret these stories of black magic in the Torah, you know, some traditions of magic have a duality, black magic, white magic, and the Torah doesn't really have much in the way of white magic. There is Kabbalah Ma'asit, you know, practical Kabbalah, the golems and these stories, but which I guess can be a sort of white magic, but magic in the Torah, the Torah's discussions of Kishuf, etc., pretty much, you know, magic and black magic are pretty much synonymous. It's always occult, usually something nefarious going on. So the question is, do we believe that magic is something that actually exists or not? And as it turns out, it is a machlokes, and we'll discuss some of the primary exponents of both these views as we go. The dominant view, I should just kind of begin with a little bit of a spoiler, or just a kind of warning, that the dominant view, certainly today, is that magic is real, that the tradition followed today, the Kabbalistic tradition, the more traditionalist view, is that magic is a real thing. Most, you know, many contemporary authors will probably take for granted that magic is true. I'm going to focus a little bit more on the kind of the classic philosophical, rationalist tradition that is not disposed to view magic as real, but I'm not necessarily giving equal time, you know, proportionate to the support each position has in the Jewish tradition. I'm just going to discuss the two main positions with, you know, my personal the perspective that interests me, maybe focusing on a little bit more. But, you know, be aware, Yosterim Masha Kosov Khan, there are many opinions that we're not going to discuss. I just want to discuss some classic debates going back to the medieval period. The most famous proponent of the view that magic does not exist is, of course, the Rambam. The Rambam discusses this in numerous different places, in his Yad HaChazakah, his halachic work, in his Pirush Mishnayos, his commentary to the Mishnah, in his Mor Nevuchim, in his philosophical work. In all these places, he takes more or less the same position, that magic is completely bogus, magic does not exist. Now, obviously, views that say magic does not exist will have to address these two narratives we've been discussing, the narrative of the Chartumim, as well as the narrative of Shaul and the Baal HaSof. But the Rambam does not directly address these. The Rambam says, in remarkably strong language, that magic is preposterous and bogus and completely fraudulent. Language in the Yad is particularly stark. After he discusses in the laws of Avodah Zarah, the Rambam's view is that magic are basically prohibitions that are kind of ancillary or secondary to Avodah Zarah. Magic were doctrines that were promulgated by the ancient pagans to support their Avodah Zarah, and he includes all this whole discussion in his laws of Avodah Zarah. The Rambam says, "Dvarim ha'elu kulan divrei sheker v'chazavein." These are all lies and frauds, and these are things that the ancient idol worshippers used to seduce people to believe in their powers. The Rambam says, "Kol ha'mamnu v'dvarim ha'elu." Anyone who believes in these things and thinks that these are true, but the Torah forbade them for whatever reason, such people are fools, mechasrei hadas. But people of wisdom, people of Tmimei Hadas, they know with rayas brurus, with clear proofs, clear evidence, kol elu hadvarim she'asur Torah, all these things that the Torah forbids, einam divrei chachma, this is not wisdom, ela tohu vehevel, nonsense and stupidity, that chasrei hadas, that people of incomplete minds, of damaged intellect have followed, v'notchu kol dark emes biglalam, they have abandoned the ways of truth, and so on. And that's the Rambam's view. It would not seem to leave a whole lot of room for ambiguity or reinterpretation. Of course, there are those who try. There are those who do somehow find some way to reinterpret this Rambam, but it's pretty clear the Rambam means exactly what he says. That's how the Rambam was understood by the Rishonim, as we'll discuss soon. The Rambam does not believe that any of the stuff is real. Now, well, any of the stuff is perhaps a slight overstatement. Not going to get into this, but the Rambam does seem to have believed that certain types of practices of divination may have some substance. The Rambam, based on his Aristotelian model of psychology, of the intellect, believed that certain faculties of the mind can communicate with God or communicate with other celestial bodies. The Rambam believes, of course, that planets have some kind of intellect, and the Rambam did believe that it was possible to know the future. Dreams have some truth, and divination, not through magic. The Rambam had a scientific explanation for it based on his science, but putting aside that form of divination, most magic, the Rambam felt, is utterly bogus.
In the context of Ruach HaKodesh or something like that? Or is this separate from those?
What, divination?
The things we're talking about.
That might be true?
this sort of like higher seichel that the Rambam...
Yeah, the higher seichel is related to his model for Nevuah. The Rambam has a kind of scientific model for Nevuah too. The Rambam does not believe that Nevuah is supernatural or innate. The Rambam believed that Nevuah was a kind of logical consequence of his scientific model of the soul and of God and of... You know, the Rambam believed there was physics, metaphysics like Aristotle, and that was all part of his scientific model, and that Nevuah could be explained, and that divination of the sort he accepted was some to be explained. For example, when you do these magic rituals, the rituals themselves have no power, he said, but the rituals can be kind of stimulants for the certain faculties in the intellect to communicate with. So the Rambam did believe there was something true, which was related to, I think was related, I don't know his model at all well, I don't understand it, I don't have a background in Aristotelian philosophy, but he did have a scientific model which explained some of it, and it was probably related to his view of Nevuah and Ruach HaKodesh, yes.
The rituals you're talking about, are you talking about like practical Kabbalah?
No, you know, I'm talking about things like they did things where they would throw sticks, and they would they would perform like different ceremonies, which Rambam certainly wouldn't have called Kabbalah, but... They would do things which the uneducated believed were just magic, and the Rambam believed more scientifically that they were somehow stimulants to the intellect. It helped the mind focus, it helped the concentration, and somehow it aided people to have this kind of somewhat legitimate form of valid form of it. Still, it might be still osir, but at least it was at least a quasi scientific process that would enable people to have some insight into the future.
Are you talking about Jews or Goyim?
Both, I think.
Okay. Is his problem that he doesn't think it really works, or is it more of a theoretical problem saying that it can't be, is there an element of Avodah Zarah? Like, you're believing in a force other than God that can do something?
People have argued that the Rambam's kind of strongness of his language and his emphasis was motivated by a concern for Avodah Zarah. He explicitly acknowledges that what's bothering him so much, what he's worried about is the fact that these things lead to Avodah Zarah. Throughout the Mar Nevuchim, he explains that half the Torah was targeted at banning pagan practices and Shatnez and certain types of other Isurim all have to do with that the Torah is waging an epic battle against idol worship. So the Rambam definitely, the reason it's an issue, the reason it's so important to him is clearly because it's Avodah Zarah. Abstractly, you know, without the context, I think he also believed it was false. There is discussion, for example, some scholars have discussed, the Rambam takes a very, very hard line rejection of astrology too. And there, the irony is that many other Aristotelians did believe in astrology because their system of the stars, they did believe that the stars have some influence over the destiny of humans on the... So it's not like our science. We think astrology is ridiculous because our Newtonian and Einsteinian and Planckian physics doesn't allow for astrology, but the Rambam's philosophy very much did allow for astrology. So some people have argued that his kind of tirade, his vehemence against astrology was motivated more by its theological implications. The Rambam waged wars against fatalism, people who believed there was no Bechira, people who believed that everything was predetermined. That was what bothered him so much about astrology, even if it wasn't another koach, but it took away people's motivation to do good. So it is possible that some of his vigor in this position was motivated by worry about Avodah Zarah, but his language also, I think, is pretty clear that he did not believe in it as an abstract matter of truth and falsehood. Also, we'll quote some other quotes to put this more in context too, so maybe it'll.
Eliezer went to look for a cow. He had some signs. He said if she would meet him. Now, was that considered?
So you're alluding to a famous Gemara that the Gemara when it talks about Nachash divination, the Gemara says. The Gemara refers to what Eliezer did as Nachash. When Eliezer did, when the Eved of Avram said, "If the woman comes out and says, I'll give your camels to drink too, then I'll know that's the right woman." So the Gemara says has some comment like "Kol Nachash Eino Eliezer ben Yaakov." That's a kind of an example of Nachash. That was an example of divination, a classic kind of archetypal example of divination. So the Mefarshim, I didn't prepare this. I'm not going to get into this. I didn't prepare this part of the discussion, but. The Farshim do ask, so why was it mutter? If that is the textbook example of divination, and divination is osur, the Torah says losod and uvelosod nachashu. So why is what he did mutter? And they give all kinds of different explanations for how that was either like classic divination or how it differed from classic divination. But yes, there is a serious discussion about what he did, why that does not constitute prohibited, but as I said, I didn't prepare that discussion, so I'm going to try to stay away from that.
According to Rambam, about the Chartumei Mitzrayim, how they did that?
That's an excellent question. The Rashba and others asked that question, and we will turn to that very soon. We'll discuss that very soon. That's exactly the question. We'll get to that very soon. I'll come back to that question in just a couple of moments. So just to quote one other member of this team, one other classic, you know, the Ben Ezra is always fun because his language, is he has that flair kind of, that he knows how to put it. The Ben Ezra says, Reke moach amru. People empty of brains ask, empty-headed people ask, if ovos, if the, you know, the practice of balas ov were not true, if kishuv were not true, why did the Torah prohibit them? Why is the Torah wasting his time prohibiting things that are not true? Says the Ben Ezra, I say hepach devrayim. I say just the opposite. The Torah only prohibits the falsehood. The Torah only prohibits sheker, not truth. Everything the Torah prohibits is false and not true. And as proof, he says, avodah zarah, elilim, psilim. He says, everything the Torah prohibits is false and not true. And that is, again, that's exactly the pattern of kishuv. Kishuv, like avodah zarah, is false, not true. And that's the position of the Rambam, that the things that are prohibited are the things that do not work, not the things that have any legitimate basis behind them. Now, the Rashba has a fascinating tshuva, several tshuvas, dealing with this question. The Rashba was actually asked a question, halacha lemaaseh. There was a ritual back then which was called the Tzuras HaAryeh, the image of the lion. It was believed to be therapeutic for some disease. Not sure what disease was, but basically they would draw a picture of a lion, and some of the details were disputed. Some people claim that there were some incense being offered, it would really bordered on avodah zarah. Some claim that's not true, that's not part of the ritual. There was this ancient, bizarre ritual, bizarre by our light certainly, that was believed to cure some disease. So the question was, is this prohibited based on the Torah's various prohibitions against kishuv, darchei hamari, another, you know, the whole complex of prohibitions against pagan practices, superstitious practices, sorcerous practices, or is this considered a valid therapeutic tool? And what makes the Rashba's tshuva so interesting is that the Rashba grapples with a fundamental philosophical problem, which is, if you consider our model of science, some things, you know, we understand pretty well. We have equations, we have things that are reproducible, we have, you know, the scientific method, empiricism, and everything. But back then, certainly, there was a lot they didn't understand. Even today, there's a lot we don't understand. You know, I think it was Einstein who said that, you know, gravity, he kind of, you know, said, spooky action at a distance. I mean, we know it. Newton modeled it. But the point is, it doesn't make sense. You know, we can demonstrate it, but spooky action at a distance. You know, if you consider the medieval mind trying to understand magnetism, we still don't understand it that well. But today, we believe, let's say, of the four fundamental forces. So we have the strong force is mediated by this particle, the weak force is mediated by that particle. Electromagnetism is mediated by photons. Gravity, they think, is mediated by gravitons. I'm not sure how well established they are yet. But, you know, so today we have some theories, some things we do understand, some things we don't understand. In the medieval period, there was certainly a whole lot they didn't understand, and it became very difficult to define what is superstition and what is superstition, what is sorcery, and what is science. You know, empiricism, things that work, we'll say are science. Some Rishonim tried to work with that model. A lot of superstition, it was believed to have worked. Again, you can do today. We do studies. We do, you know, studies are, you know, many studies are not reproducible. They keep pointing out that many scientific studies and published in good journals are difficult to reproduce. So, how do you define basically certainly? And back then, it was the problem was exponentially more difficult. How do you define what is science and what? Just because you don't understand the theory, it could still be science. If you can prove that a certain root, a certain herb cures a disease, a certain compound, when they discovered that penicillin killed bacteria, they didn't necessarily know how it worked, but they saw it worked. So the point is, you know, how do you define, is it theory, is it empiricism? What defines what is something that is science, or what defines something that is sorcery, something that is, and the Rashba grapples with this for pages. The Rashba struggles with statements of Chazal, Rambams, he goes on and on, expresses great frustration, he throws up his hands a few times and says, I wish we had a mahalak that worked, and he has a lot of trouble understanding what's science and what's sorcery. And he begins his tshuva by saying, this question of the Tzuras HaAryeh, he says, the Rashba's correspondent, who was apparently a Talmud Chacham, took the exact position that the Ben Ezra calls Reke Moach, the position that Ben Ezra called the empty-headed people. This rabbi held that way. He said, anything the Torah prohibited must be true. The Torah doesn't waste its time on falsehood. So anything the Torah prohibited must be something that works, and the Torah prohibited because it's Kachat Tumah, whatever it is. The Torah didn't like it. So that this person said, even though the Tzuras HaAryeh works, he conceded that this ritual worked to cure disease. Nevertheless, the Torah prohibits it, because that's always what the Torah prohibits. The Torah prohibits everything that works, if it's not science.
I don't remember exactly, but I know when I said that. in this case where someone or some sort of healing on some words before.
Yeah, well, amulets, Mekameot, and Lachash.
I mean, it has to be allowed, I'm saying, if you're not aware or not.
That's an important question. We'll turn to that. Again, we'll turn to that soon, hopefully. But those are the so far we've been dealing with the biblical sources, so to speak. We'll turn to the Talmudic aspect of the discussion soon. So the Rashba, the first thing he does is he tells his correspondent, you know, you assume that everything the Torah prohibits is true, and true things are prohibited and not false things. No, I understand that position, he says. However, you should know that the Rambam, Harav, Hagadol, Marit Tzedek, the Rashba was not from the same philosophical tradition as the Rambam. The Rashba was a good deal more traditional, but in his time already, you know, everyone had, you know, incredible respect for the Rambam. So he once said, I want you to know the Rambam does not agree with you. The Rambam takes, the Ben Ezra, they take the opposite position, that everything the Torah prohibits is false and not true. So basically he says that the... You know, so we have machlokes between the Rambam and between your view. He says, fine, he says, the Rashba says, humility, he says, you know, I'm not sure I can be machria this machlokes. There are two major philosophical positions here, he says. But personally, he says, I lean toward the more traditionalist position that magic does work, the things that are prohibited do work. And the examples he brings are these two biblical narratives. He says, Ba'ovi Yedoni, Bishol, Chartume Mitzrayim. And he also brings some of the things you alluded to. He brings Perichen, like he says, Shari Shemen, Shari Bayim, the Shalom Neham B'Shabbos, different types of practices of Lachash or of other types of signs and magic practices, which the Gemara permits, which indicate that the Gemara did believe some of these, the efficacy of some of these things. And as we'll discuss soon, there are numerous statements of Chazal, literally and beyond count, that Chazal, you know, overwhelming number of statements, the Chazal did seem to believe that these things are valid, these things actually work. We'll discuss the famous comment to the Gaon very soon. Just now, as a matter of fact, the Gaon, in one of his sharpest, in the Bir HaGro, which is normally a pretty dry and technical halachic work, his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, the Gaon has two legendary outbursts against the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah on matters of philosophy, matters of hashkafa. One of them is in Siman Kufayin Tes in Yeridea. The Shulchan Aruch, actually, for all the Shulchan Aruch being the Maran, being a great mystic, he talked to a Malach, he was a Kabbalist, and for all that, nevertheless, in a number of places, he kind of codifies halachas of the Rambam, which are clearly rooted in the Rambam's skeptical, rationalist, philosophical worldview, specifically when it comes to lachash, when it comes to incantations. So certain lachash is mutter, but the Rambam's language is, you're allowed to engage in lachash, even on Shabbos. Afal pish ein amol klum. It doesn't work. You're allowed to do it, maybe for the placebo effect, so the chola should be calm, you should think you're doing everything you can. But the Rambam explicitly says, afal pish ein amol klum. Lachash is, basically, it's clearly motivated by a belief, a disbelief in superstition. And the Rambam, followed by the Shulchan Aruch, say that that superstitious practices have no efficacy. So the Gaon has a legendary diatribe here. The Gaon says, that's the view of the Rambam. Kol Abayim Achara of all later authorities disagreed. And his first point is the Gemara. The Gemara has many examples of Lachash. Then he says that the Rambam was led astray by philosophy. That's why he says, whole laundry list, things the Rambam didn't believe in. The Rambam didn't believe in Chafim, in sorcery. Shemus didn't believe in magic names, divine names. Lachashim, incantations. Shadim, demons. Kmeyas, amulets. Hakol hu sheker, says the Gaon, that's very nice, but Kvarhikuosu al Kadkado, they've struck the Rambam on the head, because again, many stories in the Gemara with Shemos and Kshafim, and the Torah. The Torah says, Vayiyu Saninim. The Torah says the staves of the Khartumim turn into serpents. Again, Kmeyas again. And again, he goes after the philosophy. He says, philosophy was a Teu Barov Lekha. Philosophy led the Rambam astray because of its seductive appeal. What about the Gemara? So the Rambam doesn't directly address these stories, but the Rambam in general always says everything in the Gemara that doesn't meet his worldview is figurative, has deeper meanings, is not literal, and the Rambam finesses all the Gemaras. The Gaon says he's ochre everything we pshut on. Nothing is as it sounds. Chas v'shalom, the Gaon says, Eini maimon mehem, I do not believe these things, I do not believe these reinterpretations, this revisionism. Kol hadvarim heim kipshutan, we take all these biblical stories, all these Gemaras at face value, and so on. They do have panemius, he says, but internal, deeper things, but not the panemius of the philosophers, he says, which are really chitzonius. El shel bale emes, the true, the people who know the truth, the Kabbalists, the more traditional sources, that is the position of the Gaon. And the truth is, though, I said the Rambam is the most famous, one of the earliest of the those who reject the efficacy of magic. The earliest, this is, I think, not widely known, but it's a remarkable thing. The earliest is actually, we have statements of the Gaonim. The Gaonim, you know, the Gaonim have a very funny position in our tradition. On the one hand, we find that we Rishonim very often pay them enormous deference. They say, HaGaonim kol devrim devrei Kabbalah, they were close in time to the era of the Talmud, and they had a kind of more accurate and earlier tradition. We show never that they disagree with them too very often, but sometimes they say that we have to accept what they say because they were the masters of the early tradition. So the Gaonim, the Radak, has a discussion of the Balas Ov and the story of Shmuel. The Radak says that the Gaonim disagreed as to what exactly happened in the story of the Balas Ov. As we said, we have to explain, those who reject Kishuv have to explain, so what exactly did happen with the Khartoum and what exactly did happen with the Balas Ov. So the Radak says the Gaonim disagree. The Gaonim, meaning the leaders of the yeshivas in Bavel, people like Rav Haigon, Rav Shira Gaon, Rav Sadia Gaon, the Gaonim disagreed as to what exactly happened in the story of Shaul and the witch. He says they all agree, though. Everyone agrees that all the Gaonim agree that the story of Ov in general is Hevel v'Tohu v'Divrei Chaza v'Hitel, stupid and ridiculous and nonsensical and fraudulent. Balas Ov is all those things. So what happened in the story of Shaul and the Balas Ov? What were Balas Ov in general? So they all agree that Balas Ov in general were frauds. You know, today we have magicians, you know, the honest ones admit they're frauds, admit their entertainment or they're just a show. You know, some dishonest ones believe themselves or maybe claim that they're doing real things. So he says they all agree that Balas Ov were charlatans. They used ventriloquism. They had a little guy hiding in a box. They said they would throw their voice and they would cast their voice and make it sound like there was a magic voice coming from nowhere. So what happened here? The woman got everything right. The woman predicted battlefield defeat on the next day. She predicted his death. Everything she said was on the money. So what happened? If she had no real powers, then what exactly happened here? So Rav Shmuel ben Chofni was a, you know, even within this position, was a notorious rationalist to some extent. He says everything she did was a charade. She had her guy in the box. Everything she did was a complete hoax. When she pretended to be surprised when Shmuel came up, that was all part of her act. She was playing a game from beginning to end. How did she know what was going to happen? She guessed, the same way they do it today. They ask you a few innocent questions. They learn a little bit about you. They look at you. They see what you are, and through a series of canny, sometimes vague, she actually made pretty specific predictions. But everything she did was she basically guessed. She saw them writing on the wall. She saw the Plishtim, I guess, had a powerful force. She saw morale in Shaul's army was bad. And she threw the dice, and she guessed that that's what would happen. So he says that everything she did was part of her charade. And she pretended to be so surprised. And it was all part of her act. She was a skilled actress, a skilled fraud. When the Pasuk says, Vayomer Shmuel El Shaul, when the Torah says, Shmuel told Shaul, Shmuel was dead, That just means from Shaul's perspective, it was like Shmuel was talking to him, but none of it actually happened. It was all a hoax. And when Shmuel ben Chofni winds up with this zinger, he says, after he kind of acknowledges the fact that Chazal don't seem to have learned like that, Chazal do seem to have taken this story literally. So he has this kind of ringing expression of the rationalist credo. He says, "Afal pi shmashmos divrei chachamim zal begemar ki emes haya." Chazal seem to have believed this. The implication is that Chazal believed this. Sorry, he says, Lo yekublu advarim makom sheish machishim lehem min haseichel. We cannot accept these things because they contradict reason. Fine, so Chazal, we'll deal with that, he says, but it can't be.
How did she know he was really Shaul? How did she know that he was really Shaul? He was just as common, right?
Right, so he says, he doesn't really explain, he just says, Miyad hikira ki Shaul. I guess back then they didn't have celebrity pages. It's not like she saw in the newspaper every day pictures of King Shaul attending a party.
Shemuel said, what are you doing here, Shaul? So she knew it.
Yeah, but according to him, she was making that up. According to him, everything Shmuel did not actually come. According to his pshat, that was all her...
This lady was not a common lady. She was the mother of Abner Ben Ner.
Yeah, so he acknowledges the Chazal are learning differently, but you're right. We're going to discuss the other approach in a minute, but that is certainly the more common approach, as I said. But the Gaonim did not want to accept that. But your pshat.
If she were a complete fraud, she would have said that he was going to win.
Right. Usually, when the king comes to you, you tell him what he wants to hear. We find in Malachim, all the Nevi'ei Sheker used to always say, "You're going to win. Your battle will be successful." The Nevi'ei Emes would predict doom and catastrophe. Nevi'ei Sheker, right? So, why did she choose to do this? It's a good question, right? That's a good question. I don't know. The more traditional pshat, though, we'll get to in a second, but first, we'll discuss the pshat of some of the other Gaonim. Rav Sadia, Rav Hai Gaonim, a more prominent Gaonim, they understood that Shmuel actually appeared. The Pesukim, the Torah implies that Shmuel actually appeared. However, they also do not believe that witchcraft has the power to raise the dead. They believe, this is an even more interesting pshat in some ways, they believe that she was prepared to go through her whole charade. She was about to start her whole game. She was just as surprised as everyone else when Hashem decided to raise Shmuel from the dead. Hashem wanted to communicate with Shaul. Why he couldn't do that through the Urim V'Tumim, I don't know. For whatever reason, he didn't want to talk to Shaul through normal channels. So he decided to send Shmuel up. She was just as surprised as everyone else. That's why she cried out in a kol gadol. She was about to play her game, and all of a sudden, someone's coming up from the dead, and she was floored.
Voice only, right.
So Chazal say, I think, that Shaul heard the voice and didn't see her, and she saw and didn't hear the voice. I'm not sure how these go into my learning. He says, I'm not sure how they're learning, right? The Torah describes the voice, and the Torah says Shaul asked her, what does he look like? And she said, he looks like a zaken, otem il. So the story implies that she saw something, but I'm not sure. What Hashem actually did, according to this chat, I'm not sure. Maybe she was still embellishing with her own details, I don't know. But the core of the story is true, and there was actually divine communication here. And after the Radak brings all these chatim, the unanimous consensus of the Gaonim that in principle, Balas Ov is nothing. So he says, why would Hashem do this? He says, this is why would Hashem work through such a miserable channel like this? Why wouldn't Shaul know this? He says, Shaul was a great man. He says, Shaul was a superstitious peasant. Shaul was a great man. Shaul was one of the greatest men in Klal Yisrael. Even if he committed certain averus, he was out of favor with God. Shaul was one of the greatest men of the time. So if Balas Ov was really nonsense, he didn't know this. Even if he was desperate, he really wouldn't have known that that she was a charlatan. Sometimes people get desperate. I guess they believe what they want to believe. But the Radak cannot accept that this pshat is true. So the Radak's final conclusion is that. The Radak's final conclusion is that Chazal are correct, that Chazal, the literal, straightforward, like Moshe was saying, the pshat that this was divine communication, that this was miraculous, this was, again, whether it was normal Balas Ov or Hashem juicing it, so to speak, to communicate with Shaul, but that this was, he goes with Chazal, the pashtus that Balas Ov has power, and that's actually what was going on here. The power of the Balas Ov, and not the Balas Ov is usually a fraud. We also have to explain, as we said, according to the opinion of the Rambam, the Ben Ezra, the Gaonim, we also have to explain, back to our parasha, the story of the Chartumim and Mitzrayim. What were the Chartumim doing? They apparently created a snake, and they created blood, and they created frogs. For some reason, they couldn't do it to Kinim. According to Chazal, according to the Midrashim, Chazal give explanations for why they couldn't do Kinim. Chazal, again, seemed to take these stories at face value and accept that the sorcery really worked, and Chazal then explains why couldn't they do it for Kinim, because Chazal say that the power of the Tumor, the Shadim, has no power over a tiny object if they're too small. But otherwise, what was happening, if you accept the rationalist view, what was happening during these, what is the Torah talking about here when it tells us about the initial successes of the Chartumim? So, in a supreme irony, or perhaps not such an irony, the Ralbag, in his commentary to the Torah, the Ralbag, in many ways, is the arch-rationalist of all the Rishonim. The Ralbag goes considerably further than the Rambam in a number of ways and was sharply criticized for it by by people who followed him. He was basically someone who took the Rambam's views to their extremes. The Rambam would sometimes pull back and say, we don't understand this, or we accept the tradition. The Ralbag was, you know, one too many times, or several too many times, for some of his people who followed him felt the need to take things to their logical conclusions. There's a famous tshuva of the Rivash, where the Rivash expresses his concern that the study of philosophy can corrupt somebody's hashkafa, can mislead him, like the Gaon says, can mislead him away from true knowledge of God, understanding of Yadus. So the Rivash says, the Rambam, for all his greatness and incredible stature, nevertheless was swept away, like the Gaon says, by the lore of Greek philosophy. And then he says the Ralbag, who was a follower of his, also a great man, also a great Talmudist, also wrote a great Pirush on the Torah, but he was led even further astray than the Rambam, and he rattles off a bunch of doctrines that he thinks are unacceptable. And then the Rivash says, kind of very modestly, very charmingly, he says, And if these two Ma'aris HaGadolim, these two great luminaries, the Rambam and the Ralbag, that us compared to them, we've never seen light, we're tiny compared to them. If they can be led astray, certainly small people like us, he says, little men like us, should stay far away from philosophy. But the Ralbag basically was in some ways a kind of more extreme, more logically extremist view of the Rambam. In spite of all that, the Ralbag here is not sure whether the Khartoumim were authentic or not, because he acknowledges, not that empiricism was such a big deal in the medieval period, but he says, at the end of the day, he says, I just don't know, and I can't make a definitive statement about something I don't understand. What were the Khartoumim? He says, I'm not sure, he says. Maybe it was illusion, maybe it was some kind of sleight of hand, achizas einayim, he says. Maybe, he says, it was actual magic, he says. If that's possible, I don't know, he says. He says, lo no delo no ad hayom, we just don't know what Khartoumim are. And that's why I have nothing further to say. So at the end of the day, sometimes the hallmark of a true rationalist, a true philosopher is, you just don't know. There's a limit to how much you can speculate based on your ideas. At some point, you have to just say, I just don't know. I think I read once that Alan Turing was kept an open mind on ESP. He said, to make assumptions based on materialist doctrine is not. We have to have proof one way or another. Obviously, most scientists fail to have enough proof—the proof of failure to show up in experiments reliably. But in any event, the Ralbag is not sure. He opens the possibility of illusion. Doesn't explain how the illusion would have been performed or anything like that. So we do have a couple of later commentaries who have tried to explain what the Khartoumim did based on illusion. The Abarbanel, for example, writing in the 15th century, the Abarbanel, or early 16th possibly, the Abarbanel says that we have two opposing views, two schools of thought among the Rishonim about, as we've been discussing, about sorcery and these kind of occult and supernatural practices. We have the Rambam, the Rav Hamora, Kishuf and Shadim and all this stuff is batel, it's nothing, it's illusion, and none of it works. Then we have the opposing school of thought that believe that these things are legitimate things. On the Rambam, he says, obviously, we have a terrific problem. He says, me itain, I wish I knew, he says, what exactly happened in the Khartoumim? What were they doing? If none of this stuff actually has any power, what is the Torah describing in Parshas Vayera? What were the Khartoumim doing? So he says, basically, it's what we would call sleight of hand, the hand being quicker than the eye. The way he refers to it is tachbulos, tricks, stratagems that people do before the hamon, before masses, before audiences, b'tnuoseim, their movements, masi yadeim. They can move very quickly until things look different from what they are. And he says nothing is stable, nothing stays in the same place. It all happens so quickly. Everything is mitnoeab and mehirut. Everything just moves so fast that people's eyes can't follow it, can't perceive accurately what's happening. That's achizas einayim. That's what the Torah means. When the Torah says, Vayasu gamhem chartumim mitzrayim b'lotayim, they did the same thing. It doesn't mean literally, really the same thing. What Aaron did was a real nace, was a real miracle produced by God. What they did was simply illusion. They looked like it was happening, but it didn't actually happen. That's why he says, he has an interesting chat. He says, this is a little bit drush, he says, but that's why he says, when the Torah says, Vayivla mate aaronas matosam, it doesn't mean, like we always translate it literally, that Aaron's staff walked over and gobbled up their staves. That's not what it means. He says it's a kind of figure of speech. What the Torah means is that that Aaron's magic, Aaron's nace, conquered their nace. Aaron's nace was a better, he dominated the clash of Nisim. He won the showdown. Aaron's nace was permanent. It lasted for a long time. It was stable. People could see it was a real thing. Their nace was ephemeral. It was quick. It was changing, so it might have fooled people for a few seconds, but it was nothing of the same solidity and permanence as Aaron's nace. That's why the Yivla is just a kind of, it's like we say, he killed, he crushed, he conquered. It just means that Aaron's nace was much more permanent, much more decisive and convincing than was the Khartoumim's. When he says the Machas Tzardim, he says, also that was deception, he says, that what he says there, this is like Connecticut Yankee King Arthur's Court, he says, what they did was they saw where Aaron's Tzvardim were going to come, and they would quickly, when they saw Tzvardim about to boil out of the earth or something, they would do the mumbo-jumbo and wave their hands and say, look, Tzvardim, and then they would then take credit for Moshe's Tvardim, and that's why they couldn't remove the dam or the they couldn't remove the dam or the Tvardim. They had no real power. All they could do was piggyback or cannily take advantage of illusion or of Moshe's Nisim. They couldn't actually do anything. That's why their powers are very limited. Why they couldn't do Kinim, he tries to explain. I'm not sure I understand why. Right. The dam and Tvardim. Yes, those are the only and Kinim. I'm sorry? You know, why couldn't they take credit for that? Like in Connecticut Yankee, take credit for the Choshech. Interesting question. Some of them he warned. Those, you mean, they could have piggybacked on and scooped in.
Instead of
pay
Hartumim, do this
first. But the fact that the Torah is spending a lot of time in these, a lot of pages, Hartumim, this, that, must be that there is power. That's the power there, but is forbidden for us.
As I said,
the Egyptians, they saying we see blood in there as stronger. They made a mistake with the blood of Milah.
I understand.
So there's something there.
As I said, I'm not arguing with you. Most Mefarshim say like you. Most the more dominant sheet is the one you say. I agree. Many Medrashim, many Gemarot, most of the commentators learn like you. There is an opposing view. I understand.
You cannot live. You cannot come and turn away me from you.
I understand,
but for
yes.
The Goyim, that they don't have the Torah, they have to have something to, you know.
I understand, and again, I'm not denying that most people do learn like that, yes. As I said, I'm just exploring the position of the Rambam, but yes, it is without question, there are many strong arguments like that in favor of the other view. We mentioned, you know, the Connecticut Yankee King Arthur's Court, that there are Rishonim who explained this too, that when Moshe asked, when shall I remove the Tzardim, and Paro said, Lamachar, why did he say Lamachar instead of today? So many Mefarshim suggest because Paro still thought that Moshe was playing games like this, that Moshe knew that scientifically, astrologically, they were going to go away today, so he took advantage to walk into Paro, thinking Paro would say now, and then take credit for it. So that's why that's why Paro thought Lamachar, he'd be able to show off Moshe, but since Moshe was actually doing the Nisim with Hashem, it didn't work. But yes, that idea cuts both ways.
So according to the majority sheet that we have, or whatever, it's that work. So you really need to define what the definition is of magic versus science.
Absolutely, and that's what the Rashba has.
What is magic?
Yeah, as I said, it was a very difficult topic. The Rashba spends literally pages going through different chazals and trying to explain all kinds of skulas. He says the fact that we don't know the theory, the fact that we have no scientific theory for it doesn't make it magic. Because like I said, there's a lot of things in when they magnetism. I think the Rashba gives that example. He says we know that the Barzal follows the Evan Ashoevet. That's not magic, he says. We don't know how it works. We have no idea why it does that necessarily, but it does. So the fact that something works, he says, and we don't know why, doesn't make it magic. So what is the definition? As I said, the Rashba goes on literally for pages, and I don't think he has a completely satisfying approach. And I agree. It's not. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. It's a recognized question, and I don't have a clear answer, Lefi. Sometimes I guess you can argue that if you do have a theory for magic that involves supernatural forces, that involves demons, or that involves, again, what's a demon?
Demon,
why is a demon not science, right?
You know, some nuclear force,
right,
whatever.
Right, exactly, right. So yeah, I agree that needs a lot further clarification. And right, I'm not prepared to. Right, I don't
it's
know.
It's almost simpler to say that it's not true, right?
Right.
So
then we have a simple. Then we have a simple standard easy, well defined, and.
But then what if it's
Barshaker
Tirchak? Wouldn't that cover?
True. True, but the penalties for these things is a lot more serious. You're right. I mean, the Gemara sometimes says lav or lav b'shnei lav, and this would be an example of something with a Torah, a particular egregious class. You're right, of sheker. Yeah, it's an interesting. That your argument is essentially the position of the Rashba's correspondent, who said that anything the Torah prohibited must have been true, because the Torah is now wasting its time on falsehood, either because it's already prohibited because of sheker, or because there's no seductive. I think they say there's no seductive power in falsehood if things don't really work. Torah doesn't have to waste time on it, because who's going to do it if it doesn't work? How long? I mean, you know, we see in the real world there are things that don't work that people do follow by the millions, so not sure about that. But so I just want to add one more thing. Well, one Malbim. The Malbim also, very interesting. The Malbim was, again, a fairly traditionalist commentator, yet for whatever reason he doesn't even bring the Rambam, he doesn't bring this whole discussion, but he takes for granted that the Chartumim were completely bogus. He has a remarkably interesting and somewhat macabre shot. He says that the Khartoumim, he explains to Psukim, he says they used to train little kids to wear snake skins and writhe around like giant serpents, and everything would be so fast it would look like real snakes. And the way they would turn the sticks into snakes was they would have smoke and it would be dark and everything would be happening quickly, and the puppet masters would throw their sticks down and these little kids would come in from stage right, like grab the sticks and put them under their skins, and then they would wriggle around like snakes, and they were trained to do this, and it would all happen so quickly that it would look like magic. So he says, he brings a medrash that there were a tinoka shel dalad v'heishanim. They called, what's particularly grim and about this pshat is he says that when he reads the psukim by a shlichuish mateyu, the puppet masters, the bosses would throw down their sticks. That was the chacham and the machashvim. Then the chartumim, who were the little kids in the snakeskins, they would come running in, grab the sticks. Ayulus aninim means that the chartumim mitzrayim, those were the actors, the kids, they would turn into snakes and they would grab the sticks. And then he says that Aaron's staff, Bala HaChatubim Ba'atzmam, it swallowed up these little kids inside their snakeskins. They would just devour the whole things, and that was the end of that. What?
Literally?
Yeah. Bala HaChatubim Ba'atzmam.
With the kids.
What? The Malvim.
With the kids.
Malvin learns it was illusion too. He doesn't say why. He doesn't say. He doesn't give you the context for this.
So the Khartoumim are the kids.
Yes, the Chacham and the Machashvim were the masters, the puppet masters, and the Khartoumim were the kids. And Malvin, you know, Kedarko reads every word in the pasuk carefully and explains why the words are not redundant and are not.
So how did they do that with the dam?
The dam would have required a different trick. I don't have that here. I think he discusses the dam too. I don't remember exactly what he says, but yes, you do have to address the dam and the tzardeya. So these are basically the different shitas involved. You know, as Moshe was saying, as others were saying, there are, you know, the dominant view certainly is that these things actually worked because of numerous different arguments. The Sukkim spend time in it, the Midrashim seem to believe it. The Torah tells you everything straightforwardly without explaining that it was sheker. So the majority position certainly is that these things were frauds. But nevertheless, we have to acknowledge that there were major thinkers in the Masara, the Gaonim, the Rambam, who believed that these things were real. There is a fascinating comment from the Kutzke Rebbe. Hard to know whether to take this literally or he meant this as some kind of joke or witticism, but he basically said about certain types of supernatural things that until the Rambam came along, these things actually existed, and the Rambam basically passed them out of existence. The Rambam, it's hard to know whether he meant this seriously or not, but we have these kind of one-liners from him. He says that, and according to one formulation, he deliberately passed them out of existence because he thought they were too... First he just says, once around passing that way, Shemayim went along with him and just eradicated them. In another formulation, he writes explicitly, he says that he deliberately would pass them away because he felt that they wasn't good for people to have them around, so he deliberately kind of ruled them out of existence. Again, hard to know whether he meant that... One additional comment I'll mention is a comment of the Marsham. The Marsham discusses that the Rambam leaves out the simanim of Rosh Hashanah. The things we eat, one of our most favorite minhagim of Rosh Hashanah of all year is the apple and the honey, and the rest of the things we do, the dates and the pomegranates, Rambam leaves it out. So the Rambam leaves out, this is a topic for another day, but the Rambam leaves out many, many things that are supernatural in the Gemara. Not all, but many, perhaps most things that involve even halachas that are based on the supernatural. The Rambam leaves almost everything out. Many achronim recognize the pattern. You know, traditionally, all these Rambams were explained on an ad hoc basis. Each one, they would find some explanation for why the Rambam left them out. Many achronim, though, began to recognize the pattern, acknowledge the pattern. The Rambam systematically leaves out anything to do with the supernatural. And we have no less a figure than Marsham, who says that the Rambam left out the simanim because the Rambam leaves out anything that was supernaturally based, and the simanim, they smack of superstition, they smack of, he says, it's kala simanim, Rambam shita is, anything that's based, that's not mehekesh ativi, anything that has no rational basis, you should not do them, ain't lasil chatila, make a simon, you can't do that, that's why the Rambam left it out. Now he says Chazal didn't hold like that, and he says we Anachnu Maminim, everything we believe, everything he says in Shas and Midrashim and Zohar Kadosh and Sefer Kabbalah, V'Yikayim Banu Simana Tava Milsehu. The Ramasham says Chas V'Shalom, we accept all this as true. But the Rambam, he was willing to explain. The Rambam held that the Rambam didn't want to touch anything to do with the supernatural, so the Rambam left out such things as Simanim. No, he simply leaves them out.